Hi, this is Jacob Scher. Welcome to the Job Mob Podcast. Hi everyone, Jacob Scher here. Today's interview is with Keller Rinodo of JobSpice.com. Keller is one of the co-founders of JobSpice. Now, this interview got off to an interesting start because it's not the typical interview that I usually do where I'm asking questions of the expert. Instead, what happened was we actually got off the start where Keller was asking me questions. And so for the first half of the interview, you'll hear us talking about entrepreneurship and job search in Israel, Israeli culture, and some interesting facts that Keller learned from a career counselor at Harvard Business School. And then toward the middle of the interview, we'll kind of switch into more of a classic format for me where I'm asking the questions to Keller and he's telling us about JobSpice and how JobSpice is such a handy, easy-to-use tool for job seekers. So I hope you enjoy it, and I'll talk to you again at the end of the call, of course.
So why did you decide to move out to... Israel.
Well, actually, so like I said, I was born in Montreal, and I'm Jewish, and my family, my parents were very Zionist, so they were very much, they love Israel, and they're always encouraging us to also love Israel, and we became enamored with it too. And so, I mean, by the time I was 15, I had already been to Israel 3 times. I mean, that's a lot for someone who lives like that. Halfway around the world. And so...
And are you... Your parents spoke fluent Hebrew?
Not at all. No.
Oh, really?
No, nothing. My parents aren't Israeli. They didn't speak any Hebrew. They could barely... They could read a little bit of Hebrew, but they couldn't really speak Hebrew, no. And so... But we went to Hebrew school. And so we spoke a little bit of Hebrew. And we were... I mean, all the way through high school, I was learning Hebrew. And then I actually went to university in Israel, in Jerusalem, for a year. And came back to Canada, did another 3.5 years of university in Montreal. And then after that, I moved to Israel. And I did what's called making Aliyah, which means I became an Israeli citizen. And then I went into the army. I was in the army for a while. And
I worked for someone in the biotech field for 3 years. He was a native Israeli citizen, and he was also in the army. So I heard all of his crazy army stories. So was that like mandatory that you go into the army when you chose to become an Israeli citizen?
Well, I was 22, and at that point, which was 1998, and at that point, they weren't running after people like me to go into the army, even though. Is regular Israelis, it's at 18, they're recruited. There's mandatory recruitment. And so, but I really wanted to go. I really wanted to do it for a number of reasons. I mean, it was part of the love that we grew up with, of this idea that everyone has to do their part. And so, and I really wanted the experience. I knew that I had heard so many stories about how it was a terrific way for new Israelis like me to get integrated and to meet people, make friends for life. And become a part of society, basically. And so, I mean, the army is really, it's a very central part of Israeli society. And the amazing thing about it is that, just like any army, I mean, I have friends who are in the American army, I have friends who are Canadian army, who are in the army in Europe and Russia. And, of course, it's always difficult. The army, I mean, there are people who have easier jobs in the army, there's no question about it. There are people who had much harder things to do than I did. But there are difficult moments, that's for sure. And so... one of the amazing things about going to the army, and this is a lesson for life for anyone, it's one of the reasons why I encourage people to do things like this, is that the army, it's a situation of life or death. It really is for a lot of people. And so the army wants to know what they've got when they've got you in front of them. And so they're going to test you to see, they're going to basically stress test you. They want to know when you're going to break. How far can you take this person? Excuse me. And a lot of people, they can go their entire lives without ever being stressed like that and never really knowing how far they can be pushed. And the fact is that most people, they have a tremendous amount of potential and they don't even know. And no one ever tells them, and they never realize it. And so that was really something that was amazing for me, was to learn things about myself that I would have probably never known otherwise. I mean, the only other situation I can think of where people are tested that far are in sports, in professional sports or Olympic sports, where they're trying to figure out how they
can. Right, I can see that.
But even then, there's a mental aspect to it, and there's a physical aspect to it. And here it's beyond that, because, I mean, if you have to run for your life, or you just have to run for a gold medal, I mean, just have to run for a gold medal, of course there's a lot of
yeah,
pressure to win the gold medal.
Just do that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not the same, but it really is amazing. Excuse me, I still have a bit of a cold.
So what's an example of that? What's a specific scenario where that you went through in the Army that you thought was, you know, where you broke down or where you found that limit?
Well, just I think the first one for myself that I remember, there were probably other things too, but this one was something that really stuck in my mind. I'm an asthmatic, okay? And so I've grown up with the stigma of not having to be outside in the winter too much, because it can give me problems. And I used to go to the hospital a few times a year and stay there for like a week type of thing. And so, and I grew up feeling that, okay, everyone around me, I may be doing sports like everybody else, but I mean, I would get tired much quicker. I'd have breathing problems and stuff like that. And, and so there are things that I always thought were out of reach. I never really thought that I could get in shape to the point where I could run a lot like other people. I just thought that it was something I couldn't do. And even when you're in basic training, and I was in the lowest level of basic training. Like I was not going into an elite unit. And they saw they knew I have asthma. They were like, okay, they knew there was only so far they could take me. But even then in basic training, you spend a lot of time running back and forth from places. And so if you're in one part of your base, and they say, okay, you have 30 seconds to get to the other side of the base to get to a meeting room. Go now. Go. And it's like that, like literally 15 times a day. Between every single meeting, you have like 30 seconds or 15 seconds or a minute. And you have to run. That adds up. It adds up. And then at the end of basic training, we had some physical tests where we're supposed to finish, let's say, we were supposed to run a couple of kilometers in, I think in like 4 minutes or 8 minutes or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was. Whatever it was, it seemed impossible. I mean, at the beginning, I was like, there's no way. It'll never happen. And then I actually did it. I mean, I wasn't the fastest person, but I wasn't the last either. But my lungs were on fire when I finished it, but I did it.
Right.
And it was like one of the greatest feelings ever. I had done something that for so long I thought was impossible. And frankly, it really wasn't that much. I mean, all I did was run.
That's a pretty cool feeling, though.
Yeah. Oh, it was just total elation. I mean, I don't think up to that point, I don't think I'd ever felt that feeling before. It was amazing. It was really, really amazing. Yeah.
How long was your stay?
I was actually in the Army for 13 months. And so most of my friends were there for 3 years. So it's hard to compare. But
gotcha.
But it was definitely enough for me to get a good glimpse of everything that goes on there, to get a good feeling of highs and lows. And like I said, to make friends for life, to become fully integrated, to understand what it really means to be an Israeli. And even to this day, it's funny, it feels like you're interviewing me. It's like when I, for example, my first job after the Army, which incidentally the Army helped me get indirectly, was to work for Amazon.com.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In Israel?
No. I worked in France.
Okay.
So how did that work? And so I just want to forget what I was going to say before, but the idea was that when I got out of the Army, or towards the end of that, this was in around November 99. And so this was like the middle of the internet boom, right? And I already had, I taught myself in university how to program on the internet. And I knew it was a skill that was very much in demand. And it was something that when I was in the Army, I was able to convince my commanders to let me do things for them on that score. Because it could really be helpful, and it was. And so I worked on creating an intranet, which is like, it's like an internet, but internally for a company.
Sure, sure.
And so I did that for my base, which was a really, really big base with hundreds of people, maybe even a few thousand. And And then towards the end of my service, when I was getting out, and so I had decided, like most of my friends there at the time, that afterwards I want to go away. Okay, I want to leave the country. I want to go touring, just do something to chill,
right.
compress, and so on. And so I said, okay, well, unlike most of my friends, I was living alone. I didn't have, my parents weren't living as well. I didn't have them giving me money or anything like that. And so I said, okay, well, if I'm going to go someplace, I got to go someplace where I can work, and using the money that I'll earn, then I'll tour. And so I decided on Europe, and then ultimately became Paris. And so I sent, I put together a CV that mentioned that I'd been in the army and so forth.
Oh, Jacob, are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Hello?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I can hear you. You just cut out for just like 5 seconds there. No, I can hear you.
Okay, that's just Skype. And so so I sent CVs, and eventually I was telling them, I'm going to come to Paris. I wanted to go to Paris. I'm going to come to Paris, and we can interview there. And literally the next day, I sent 15 CVs one night. And the next day, I had 7 replies. Six of them wanted to interview me, and 4 of them made job offers like 2 weeks later. So it was pretty crazy, yeah. And I went to Paris right after I got in the army, like a week after I went there. And one of the reasons that Amazon hired me, the CEO of Amazon France at the time, he was so impressed when he introduced me to the company. He's like, this guy made the intranet for the Israeli army. And we were like clapping. I'm like, whoa. It wasn't the whole army. It was just a major base. But whatever. I mean, if that's what helped, that's fine. But so, yeah, so that actually, it helped a lot. And what was I going to say before? I don't remember. Why was I going with this?
How have you found Israel compared to growing up in Canada and then moving to Israel? You know, what like the culture out there?
Well,
I mean, it's got to be a lot. It's got to be a pretty big change.
Yeah, it is pretty different. The I mean, one of the things that I like to tell people is that in North America, people live to work. And here, right. People work to live. And so it's a big change. I mean, it's like when I was working for Amazon, I mean, I was having a ball. I had a great time. But I was working a lot.
Right.
Even though it was already a big company at that point, it had a startup feeling to it. And so, I mean, especially when we were just about to launch Amazon.fr, which was the reason I was hired, we were working from like 7 a.m. till 2 a.m., and then they would shuttle us home. We'd come back then 5 hours late. I mean, it was insane. But it wasn't like that all the time. I mean, after the launch, it calmed down a bit. But I was still working anywhere from 55 to 70 hours a week. I mean, I would log in on Sundays, sometimes even Saturday nights. I mean, it was pretty crazy. But we loved doing it. I mean, we enjoyed working there. And so for us, it wasn't such a bad thing. Most people, though, aren't like that. Most people will work those long hours because they feel they don't have a choice, but they don't enjoy it nearly as much. And so it really does become a burden on them. In Israel, however, which is closer to the Europe joie de vivre mentality, people, especially people who aren't in high tech, but people are much more interested in just doing their work and then going home and just enjoying their life, whether it's going to the beach or going to movies or going out or whatever. People just... They want to enjoy life. That's really what it is, and so that colors things very differently. It's not unusual in Israel to see kids, like 10-year-olds, on the street at midnight. That's another thing that people. There isn't the same sense of. It's also just so much a sense of danger. It's less a sense of paranoia about what can happen. And kids grow up more mature. Faster, partly because it's a country that's at war, and that colors almost everything that goes on here to some extent. But it's also for other reasons too. It's a country that's going back 60 years, where you had, whether people were in the army or not, there are always people looking, like for example in the kibbutz, people help each other out. It's like one big family. And that mentality still exists to some extent, much less now, but to some extent. And so when everybody has to help and play a part, well, that means everybody has to have some level of responsibility. And so even today, people still give their kids a lot more responsibility than you would see typically in North America. Compared to my own upbringing, that's for sure.
Sure, sure.
I would not be on the street normally at midnight at 10 when I was 10 o'clock.
There's just not enough social trust here in North America, I think.
For sure. And in some cases it's justified. In some cases it's not justified. It's just that it's become part of the social framework, I guess you could say. But it's just a specific example.
It's really interesting. I was I am enrolled to attend Harvard Business School in a year. Mm-hmm. And I went. They invited us out there for this kind of, I don't know, it was like a weekend where you meet all the other students who have been accepted. Mm-hmm. And we were talking to this career counselor, and he's not a career counselor, but he advises people on their future. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like the career counselor for Harvard Business School.
Okay.
And he was telling us, he was showing us these really interesting studies, which showed that what you thought, how good you thought you were, was a better predictor of your success than how good you actually were.
For sure. That's 100%
true. Which was really interesting. And then what he showed us is the whole map of the world. And he was like, the first thing he said is, now, you know, what do you think this has to do with men and women? Do you think we see different things in men and women? We said, oh, we think men are more confident. And that turns out to be true. Mm-hmm. But then he said, you know, of all the countries in the world, what do you think is the most self-empowered country? Or at first he said, so, you know, what do you think is the least self-empowered country? So the lowest self-confidence index, if you look across all the countries, do you know what country has the lowest self-confidence index?
No, I really don't.
It's actually Japan.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Really interesting, because Japan is actually this, like, they have this incredibly humble culture. Their culture is all of humility and conservatism. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to very, very low self-confidence. And then he asks, what do you think is the country with the highest self-confidence? And like one kid raised his hand, he was like, the U.S. He was like, completely wrong.
Really?
This other kid raised their hand. You can probably guess.
Yeah, I can imagine where this is going.
Yeah, it's Israel.
Yeah,
and he was showing us, and then he was showing us the effect of, of that self-confidence on the rates, for example, the percentage of people who become entrepreneurs in a country. Mm-hmm. And Israel also has the highest percentage of entrepreneurs in the entire world.
Yeah, that's true. That I know.
So I just thought that was fascinating. It was so interesting. So yeah. It's got to be really cool. I mean, it's got to be a good culture, especially for someone doing what you do.
Well, it can be very exciting. I mean, people are very, very outgoing. They love the idea of throwing things up on the wall to see what sticks.
Right.
And so there's a lot of that. And one of the things that I like to tell people, for example, in my family, my father was an entrepreneur. My grandfather was an entrepreneur. And I really thought that I would become an entrepreneur. I thought that I would go into business school. This is like when I was in high school, I thought I would go into business school as well. And then I completely by chance, I fell in love with computers and I decided to change directions. And but then later on, I started thinking, you know, once I'd been in computers for a few years, I said, you know, but I can, of course, do the startup thing as well and come back to that entrepreneurial idea that I had earlier. And so I started learning about that, and JobMob came about also. And one of the first things that I realized was this parallelism. There are so many things that are parallel to being an entrepreneur and being a job seeker, right? And one of the reasons why being a job seeker is so difficult is because obviously people they haven't been taught how to do it. So they don't know really what to do. They're just doing what people said. They're like the typical thing to do, but they don't even know how to do well because no one ever.
Right.
And that's the same thing for lots of entrepreneurs. A lot of entrepreneurs didn't go to business school. They didn't get an MBA. They just had an idea. They thought they could make money with it. And so they said, I'll start a business. And of course, just like many job seekers have a hard time, they fail consistently at getting interviews or getting jobs. Lots of entrepreneurs fail in their first year as well. And so one of the things that I realized too was that the most successful entrepreneurs, people like Donald Trump, a typical example, they have failed I mean, they're utter failures. They are complete and utter failures. They have failed so many times. So many times, and like spectacularly, yeah. like hundreds of millions of dollars have been wasted and thrown away and lawsuits. I mean, just complete nightmarish scenarios, but they're not remembered for those things.
Right.
Because among those failures, they have had some successes and very notable successes that have easily outweighed their failures. And so that's really what a job search for many people is about too. Ultimately, when they do get that success of finding a job, it was after many failures. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, of course. Just like for entrepreneurs, it doesn't have to be that way either. But it's a very similar thing that happens. The average job seeker and the average entrepreneur share.
Right.
The idea is to really make people understand that failure isn't something you should be afraid of. I don't remember who said it. Some famous entrepreneur also was saying that failure, like, success is great, but failure is even better because then you can learn. And it's true. If you understand what went wrong and you take away something from it, you're basically helping yourself improve, which means that you have a better chance of succeeding next time. That's a really important thing to keep in mind. Now, of course, I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, people, when I say things like this, I always get comments from people who, for example, not necessarily, but who are going through like job search depression, for example. They're just like, oh, you're being patronizing. You're making it sound like it's so easy. No, that's not it. I'm not at all trying to cheapen what they're going through. That's not it. That's not what I'm trying to do. On the contrary, I'm trying to make people realize that failure is it's not a necessary element, but it's a very common element. And if you have the right attitude, you can use that to your advantage and really help people, of course, do that. And so in Israel, there's the expression where we say that the Israelis, they weren't told that something was impossible, and so they tried to do it. and they sometimes figure out that it is possible.
Yeah.
And so it's this idea before, like I was saying, where you just throw stuff up on the wall and you see what sticks. There's really this idea. They get an idea and they just go out and do it. They're just like, oh, I can do it. And sometimes they actually do it. And there are other people who would say, oh, it's impossible. And they won't even try. And they won't even try because someone else told them it was impossible. They won't even try. But in Israel, you don't have that culture of shutting people down as much and saying, oh, what are you wasting your time for? It's never going to happen. No. It's not part of the culture as much, not nearly, no. And again, this goes back to, I'll just give you an example. I was yesterday, my sister is currently touring Israel for the first time in like 20 years. And so she's trying to do all these touristy things. And so yesterday I was with her touring a little bit. And we went to a couple of exhibits and museums that were about the independence of Israel and the war. The independence war that took place in 1948 and a little bit into 49, and all these things they had to go through. I mean, the odds seemed just absolutely insane. I mean, 1% of the population died. There were the armies of six or seven countries were attacking them, and they didn't even have a complete army. I mean, they had what ultimately became the IDF had existed in different shapes and forms for a few years, but it wasn't the regular army. They didn't have divisions and units and tanks and all that, and it just seemed impossible. But their back was up against the wall, and they said, "Well, it's either this or we're out of here. We're dead." So
do
it. And they did. And it's an amazing story. There were so many things that happened in that story that could have easily been told, and probably people were thinking, "Yeah, forget it. It's over. There's no way." But they did it, and so that momentum just kind of propelled things forward from there. And they're just afterwards a constant string of examples of people doing things that were supposed to be impossible, but they pulled it off. People here, it's funny, on the one hand, you might say it's an overcompensatory inferiority complex, but I mean, it's a small country, right? It's a tiny, I mean, Israel is the size of New Jersey, right? It's half the size of the island of Vancouver.
Right, it's crazy.
It's tiny, and yet it's accomplished so much, and it's known for so many things. And so, like you said, it's not at all for an Israeli to hear that Israel is the number one country in terms of self-confidence, like you were saying. That's not at all surprising when you actually look at the track record. It really, really isn't. But even then, and again, this relates to every job seeker and entrepreneur, even then, there are so many examples of failures too. There are lots of failures. There are lots of failures,
right.
But it's the successes that people remember, and that's really what brings us back to the job search. Is that, I mean, it's the job. It's like when people don't ask you when you're on your job search, how many times did you fail? I want to tell me about all the companies you applied to and you didn't make it in. No, they want to know about the companies that actually did hire you and what you did for that. They want to know about your successes. They don't want to know about your failures. It's understandable. Everyone has, I mean, typically people do have a long list of failures. And again, as long as you learn from them, it's fine. So, inspiring stuff.
I think that's totally fascinating. And that's exactly what he was talking about. He was talking about the fact that this guy at HBS was talking about the fact that if you have a really high self-confidence, even if you fail more often because you're actually not as good as those other people,
right.
Even if you fail more often, you chalk that failure up to circumstance and you try again. Yeah. Whereas if you have low self-confidence, you see failure as the confirmation of what you've always expected.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. There's no motivation to go beyond that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing. So, and this is next year you're going to be going to Harvard Business School?
No. So, I graduated from Harvard undergrad last year.
Mm-hmm.
And JobSpice was founded by myself. One of the co-founders of Facebook, Andrew McCollum,
okay.
Who is also a Harvard graduate. He's just a little older than I am. And then a guy from UT Austin.
That's three people?
Yeah. So it was,
how did it come about?
And then John Simmons. So actually it's interesting. The product was, JobSpice was originally designed by Dane and Andrew.
Okay.
The slightly older guy from Harvard and Dane from UT Austin.
Mm-hmm.
They designed the tool, and then Andrew decided to go back to Harvard for a graduate degree of education. He wants to go into, I think, educational policy.
Mm-hmm.
And the site was sort of. The site was sort of struggling to find an audience, and I was talking to Dane randomly about working on another project, and ended up sort of telling Dane, you know, geez, man, what you really need is someone to come in and design a whole business around the tool that can they sort of make it self-sustaining and that can go find people to use it.
Sure.
Because the number of people coming to the site every day was declining and declining and declining because we basically had no strategy.
When did it actually go on the internet for the first time?
It went on the internet, I believe, in August of 2009.
Okay.
And, you know, it's just really interesting because when I looked at it, and you've seen JobSpice now,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But I almost wish I could show you what it looked like. When we started working on it, so basically when you went to JobSpice before, it would take you straight to the way they originally designed it is you would go to JobSpice and it would take you instantly into the blank page that mm-hmm. is the resume builder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all you would ever see. And so it got some really great media attention. But, you know, it sort of needed a business designed around it, basically. The whole vision for the entire application at the beginning was that it was originally Dane's idea, and Dane had tried designing his resume and seen other people at University of Texas Austin struggling to design their resumes.
Sure.
And it stinks. I mean, I can tell you, I designed my resume when I was graduating from Harvard last year, and it took me at least 20 hours. And I left it until the very last minute because I thought it was going to take me an hour.
Right.
It takes, you know, designing a resume from scratch in Microsoft Word takes hours and hours and hours to do because doing any of the formatting, aligning bullet points, making sure they're of the same size, creating an attractive design is a huge pain in the butt. So it actually took me about 12 hours to design my entire resume, write all of the content. And then it took me to additional 2 hours to find a PDF converter online that wouldn't break the formatting of my resume when I tried to convert it to PDF. So
it's just, isn't that just the kicker? It's like you spent all this time to design it And then you try to print it to a PDF file. It doesn't at all resemble what you spent hours working on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on.
So
Yeah.
you can imagine, and this was at like, because you know, I was and I just know that my experience isn't unique, but you know, I left it until about 9 p.m. and I was thinking, you know, I was writing my thesis at that time and also applying for jobs, so I was just the typical stressed out college student. And I waited until 9 p.m. Ends up taking 12 hours. My the resumes were due at noon, I think. So it's like 9 a.m. I'm on no sleep, and I am trying to find a PDF converter online. You can imagine, like, spending 2 hours doing that at 9 a.m. after pulling an all-nighter was not
No
a lot of
stress.
fun.
No stress, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think you know, when I started talking to Dane and we started thinking, geez, like, it's such a powerful tool. It can make students' lives so much better. The question was, how can we put it into as many people's hands as possible? And how do you do it in a way that will make JobSpice sustainable in the long run?
Right.
And so
Okay.
that's really where we've been headed over the last 6 months
Well,
that I've been working on JobSpice.
it's pretty impressive. I mean, you've already been mentioned. JobSpice has already been mentioned in a number of very well-known publications, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, we were on TV on NBC. We had an article written on it about us in TechCrunch, and an
Yeah.
article written about us in PC World and Fast Company. So, yeah, we've gotten a lot of people have looked at it. I just think it's probably something. It's so simple, you know. The application is not doing anything revolutionary.
Right.
You know, the for us, our whole philosophy was, you know, you can try to design two different kinds of software. You can be the Adobe Photoshops of the world, which means you have about 1,000 buttons and it's really, really powerful software, but it
Right.
is impossible to use without an 1,000-page manual.
Absolutely.
Or you can be the Macs of the world, you know, the Apple computers, which just open it up and it works and you don't need instructions. It's just totally intuitive.
So sorry, go on.
No, yeah. So anyway, you know, we're hoping that we're Macs, basically. You know, like when students go onto the site, they don't need any instructions. Everything works the way you would think it would work, the way
Yeah.
you wish it worked in Microsoft Word. And it's super, super simple.
And I mean it doesn't require like spending an hour, like you said, learning the different ins and outs. They just go on, they just use it.
People design their resumes in 5 to 15 minutes,
Wow.
depending upon whether they have their content written. So if you already have so for example, I had a resume in Microsoft Word that I
Right.
didn't think was very attractive. It took me about 2 minutes to copy and paste that straight into JobSpice, choose an awesome style that John, our designer, had created, and turn it into a resume that looked like I had paid $2,000 to have someone professionally design it.
So okay, so you said that's for someone who already has the content written. I mean, it's
Right.
understandable. It takes time to think the words through, to look up the information of the history of your job, of your career, your career path, your work history, and so forth. That's understandable. That would take longer. But basically, it's just so easy to use the tool that once you have that written content, it's I mean, it's a few minutes and there you go.
Right, exactly.
And so what's the like what are the best practices? What would you say are the best ways for getting the best results?
What do you mean by that exactly? You
I mean
mean,
like
how do you
okay,
write a really good resume?
so you just gave me a good example. If possible, have your content written up already. Means that using JavaSpace will be super, super quick, right? But what
Right.
about
But so but the beauty of JobSpice, is it's built for someone who hasn't designed their resume ever.
Okay.
It's and so you know, if you have your resume built, it's very, very easy to kind of take that content into JobSpice and format it, which is sort of the whole thing that's so hard to do in Microsoft Word and is absolutely no fun. It's doing all the formatting. But additionally, for people who are just designing their resume for the first time, JobSpice makes it really easy to sort of frame your thinking. Because in JobSpice, you are able to choose from all of these different categories. So if you choose publications, for example, we're going to ask you for all the kinds of information that an employer would expect to see if you had any publications. And then we format it for you in a way that looks attractive and is, you know, very readily understandable. For education, you know, we ask specifically for, you know, what's the institution, what's the date, where is it, what are the details, what's your GPA, things like that. So even within each category that people are choosing, and you can sort of, the cool thing about the interface is everything's drag and drop customizable. Right. So you just, you know, you just drag different categories onto the page, you fill them out, you might decide that you want to reorder them, so you can just drag and drop them to where you want them on the page. And the nice thing for someone who's just creating their resume for the first time is that those categories are going to guide you in terms of the kind of content and the kind of structure you should be using, but not hinder you or limit you in any way. Everything is ultimately 100% customizable in terms of renaming the sections or leaving off parts. You can always leave things blank, and the resume will automatically, when it goes and designs that resume for you, the application will automatically take those things into account.
So like you said, I mean, for someone who doesn't even know how to design a resume or might not even be 100% sure of which sections need to be there, just the fact that they're going through the tool will guide them de facto.
Right. It's perfect. This is, I mean, honestly, this is what we wanted to have when we all designed our resume. It's totally perfect for someone who is coming out of college or, is applying to college, or for someone who already has a resume but designed it in Microsoft Word and, you know, didn't have the disposable income to pay $1,000 to someone to design their resume. So they designed it in Microsoft Word and it just doesn't look that professional. It's perfect for all those people. I mean, it's extremely fast, extremely easy. It requires honestly, that's so critical for us that we've tried to keep it as simple as possible. Like, what is, you know, you want to be so simple that it's fun. We find simple is usually fun. Complicated is usually frustration.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So someone goes in, they create a resume using one of the designs that you have there. There are multiple designs.
Yeah. We have about 30 designs on the website right now, I think. And they're all designed by, John, who's one of the founders of JobSpice. Mm-hmm. And before he came on to JobSpice, he actually ran his own professional resume design company.
Oh, okay.
So he is one of the guys who was charging, you know, a lot of money to sort of design personal brands for people before, we went and started working with John and said, look, let's leverage, you know, these awesome designs that you have. Mm-hmm. And you know, if we can code them on JobSpice, we can make them available to a million people instead of the, you know, the 15 to 20 people that you might be able to work with in any given month.
Right. And so once someone, you know, they go in 15 minutes later, they have their beautiful resume. And so then what happens?
Okay. So then you can instantly publish to PDF. So that's going back to what I was telling you about before. So the beauty of JobSpice is that with the click of a button, it will instantly export it to PDF. It will never break the format. It will never ask you, you know, for, you know, your email or anything complicated. You know, the problem with these PDF converters online is that they ask you for your email, you give them your email, and then they send you spam email for the rest of your life. So with JobSpice, you don't deal with any of that. You can instantly export it to a PDF, or with the click of a button, you can actually create your own website that features your resume.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay, so you know, you go onto JobSpice and you know, for anybody listening to this, seriously, go to jobspice.com and, you know, click go into the tool and build a resume and go ahead and try to, you know, publish your click publish, and then you click create your own website on jobspice.com. Mm-hmm. And essentially it will create a unique URL for you that's hosted by JobSpice.
Okay.
And it features your resume with a really attractive background color. And then there's a button that says download as PDF.
Okay.
So what's great is that with all of these sort of modern forms of social media, or these social networks like Twitter and Facebook, it's really hard. You can't actually send a PDF. So if you had your employer's email address, yeah, you might email them a PDF. You might also email them the URL. But the real key for the real reason that URL is really, really useful is that when you want to tweet about your resume, you tweet the URL, you tweet to your entire social network and say something like, you know, hi, my name is Jacob, and you know, I designed the internet for the Israeli army. Yeah. And I'm looking, you know, I'm looking for a job. Do you know of anything that would fit me? And so we hear from people constantly that they find jobs by tweeting about their resumes or by putting it on Facebook and asking their friends for feedback or recommendations for people to go interview. And then additionally, you can make it searchable by Google, which essentially then means that when anybody searches for your name or any other content that might be in your resume, your name is often the first thing that comes up. And it's in the form of a website with your resume that highlights all of your qualifications.
Okay, and what are the advantages of being found by Google in that case?
So, the advantages of being searchable by Google are that, so for example, I just heard today 75% of all recruiters in the U.S. are searching for the people who they're hiring. Mm-hmm. So even if someone hears about you through sort of non-technological means, you know, let's say they actually get a paper resume from you at a job fair. Mm-hmm. Before they decide whether to interview you or not, they are going to go Google your name and see what they can find online. And so the advantage of being able to publish a really professional looking resume and have that be the first thing that comes up instead of, you know, some picture of you doing a keg stand in college is pretty stark. It's like it's a good first impression. But the other advantage is that I've actually heard from students who they got on JobSpice, they used JobSpice, built their resume, downloaded it as a PDF, made it, you know, created the website and made it searchable by Google kind of as an afterthought. But then they sent out their, you know, they sent out their resumes, got a couple interviews, nothing really worked out. But then they got these interviews with people who they didn't send resumes to. And I was talking to this one student in Arizona. He actually posted his resume online, and an employer was searching for something like ASU student intern sales. And his resume actually came up on JobSpice because he had talked a lot about his ASU background in education and the fact that he was looking for an intern position, and the fact that he lived in Arizona, and that he was specializing in sales.
Oh.
And so Google is going to go ahead and index all of the content of your resume. So they don't have to be searching for your name. Employers might also be Googling for the kinds of people that they're looking for.
So, I mean, that's what we typically call a passive job search. That's you attract people to you just by doing the right things.
Right.
Yeah. Terrific. Okay. Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you before we close it out is that you talked a lot about students, but one of the things I'd like to tell older job seekers who are having difficulty finding, because people are saying, oh, you're overqualified, or they're looking for reasons to not say you're too old and so forth, is that if you want to show that your skills are still relevant, well, you got to do the same things that the younger job seekers are doing. And so in this case, if JobSpice is such a terrific tool for let's say, the first-time job seeker, the first-time career job seeker, I would tell someone who's an older job seeker, say, listen, you know, go and use that tool also so that you come across on the same level as them. Now, is there any specific thing to say to that type of job seeker, the older job seeker, that you think makes JobSpice useful too?
You know, it's funny. JobSpice might be more useful to that kind of person because it is really simple. And it's designed, I mean, we've been doing usability tests. One of the people who's working with us, his name is Ben, and he has been helping us do usability tests with all kinds of different users, from very experienced, from very tech-savvy users to very non-savvy users.
Right.
And so JobSpice has been designed specifically with non-savvy users in mind. So even if, you know, Microsoft Word seems like, God, that's complicated enough. I really don't want to deal with another application on top of that. JobSpice is designed to be about 100 times simpler to use than Microsoft Word. It is so intuitive that I truly challenge people, because of all the emails we get of people saying, I want that feature, or this didn't work, or there was a bug in Internet Explorer version 8.1, whatever. Of all the emails we get, we've never gotten an email saying, like, I was just confused. I didn't understand how to do it.
Right. It's just that easy.
So honestly, for people who find themselves generally intimidated by technology, or even intimidated by a lot of these things that blogs like JobMob are talking about, Jacob, a lot of these more relevant job search tools, like maybe tweeting about your qualifications, mm-hmm. or possibly having your own website that highlights your work experience. Yeah. All of those things, the easiest way to get those things is on JobSpice. I mean, honestly, with a click of a button, I'm not a really, really tech savvy guy myself, but I can figure out that I just click this button and enter what I want the URL to say.
Yeah.
Most people choose to just have it say their name. And then JobSpice instantly makes your resume for you. That's simple enough for me. I think it's going to be simple enough for most of the people that you were describing.
Right. Very cool. Well, thanks a lot. I had a great time talking to you, Keller. I think that it's there's no question. If anything, it can save time while at the same time getting better results. I mean, it's just win-win.
Right.
So that's just go to JobSpice, JobSpice.com, and just do it. You make it seem like that's really all there is to it. I mean, just in the time we've been talking, people could have had their resumes done to them already.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, if you've listened to this podcast, maybe we'll get some responses, and people will say that they designed their resume while they were listening to the podcast and finished before we did. That would be cool.
Terrific. Okay, thanks a lot, Keller.
Sure, Jacob. My pleasure.
Thank you, Keller. And thanks also to the rest of the JobSpice team for being the sole silver sponsor of the 2010 JobMob Guest Blogging Contest. I hope that you learned a lot from this double interview. I hope that you'll also take the time to head on over to JobSpice.com to check out their cool tool for putting your resume up on the web. And as always, if you're interested in hearing other interviews with experts like this one, just head on over to jobmob.co.il/podcasts, PODCASTS, and you'll see the entire JobMob podcast archive there. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.